Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast presentation titled Managing Overactive Bladder from Dual Diagnoses to Geriatric Challenges. I'm Dr. Wayne Kwong, and I'm a urologist in Albuquerque, New Mexico. In recognition of Bladder Awareness Month, this MedCast series delves into the complexities of overactive bladder management across different patient populations. From exploring gender-specific challenges and the dual diagnosis of overactive bladder and benign prostatic hyperplasia, BPH, to addressing the unique needs of elderly patients. This series provides a comprehensive look at the latest treatment strategies and patient care approaches. Join us for an in-depth discussion on improving quality of life for all of those affected by OAB. And joining us for this conversation is Dr. Matt T. Rosenberg. And without further ado, please give your own introduction because this is such a unique story.
Yeah, well, Wayne, thank you so much. And thank you for inviting me to this meeting. I'm not sure how unique my story is. It is a little different. As you know, and some of the audience may know, I am in primary care. I'm in Jackson, Michigan, which is somewhere between Ann Arbor and Lansing, for those of you who know it. I'm in primary care, as I mentioned, but I started in urology. I was actually in my chief year in Boston in my residency, and I decided I would switch careers. And I went into primary care, and that's what I've been doing for the last 30 years. But interestingly enough, what happened when I entered primary care, I realized how much urology was getting missed. You know, primary care are not necessarily taught how to do urologic issues, but I will tell you, we're in a very unique position, is that the patient presents to us first. It's not like you wake up in the morning and say, gosh, you know, I have a problem with my bladder, my prostate, my kidney, whatever. I'm going to go see a urologist. You don't know what a urologist is for the most part. And if you do, you're kind of scared because you guys put things in places that patients don't necessarily want things put. And they go to their primary care doctor and say, what should happen? What should I do with this? And if we're not aware of it, we can't treat it, let alone refer it. And the other interesting thing is that we have failed over time to really educate primary care as well as we should. And that's something that it's been a goal of my career, teaching my colleagues how to understand urologic diseases to present them to their colleagues. You know, today we're talking about OAB, BPH, you know, overall LUTS, lower urinary tract symptoms, but it's also prostate cancer. It's also infertility. It's also sexual function. It's renal issues. It's all of those things added up. And since we're the gatekeepers, if we can make it our mission to at least present those issues to our patients, I think we're doing a lot better.
And as you're working on the front lines, educating your peers, I mean, when you coach them up, what are the signs indicating that there's a progression going on from OAB or BPH to that dual diagnosis? And how is that impacting treatment and management decisions?
No, that's a wonderful question. And we deal with this all the time. And I'm actually going to quote one of my friends and somebody I admire a great deal, Diane Newman out of Penn. And you probably know Diane. She's a doctor of nurse practitioner, very, very well published. And she and I were working together on a paper a couple of years ago. And she said, Matt, the reality is BPH and OAB in the male, clearly, because the prostate coexist more often than not. And the problem is we don't actually see it. So we really need to change how we approach this. Now, you had mentioned earlier in our conversations, Dr. Alan Wien, who obviously is the guru of this, of the whole world of LUTS, and a tremendous amount of respect for Alan. You know, Alan said years ago, the problem is a failure to void, a failure to store, right? So let's think about it this way. And this is how I present it to my peers. You've got the bladder. And what is the bladder's main function is to store urine and to empty urine. So everything about the bladder, and I've written about this for 20 years now, is all about volume, right? The prostate, on the other hand, has a function of fluid for seminal emission during our fertility years. And then its other function is to stay the heck out of the way. Unfortunately, it didn't get that memo. And from an anatomic standpoint, the prostate's not in a great position. I mean, it'd be a lot easier after our fertility years, our prostate, you know, climbed out of our pelvis and came up on our arm and sat on our shoulder. It would make prostate exams a lot easier and men wouldn't fight it so much. Obviously, that's not going to happen. But so the prostate, as we get older, our prostate gets bigger. All right. Why does it get bigger? Honestly, I think, and Steve Kaplan had taught me this years ago as well. I mean, there's all these guys who do great work in this field. You know, I think it's a vascular problem. I think as we get older, we get poor flow to our prostate. In that state of ischemia, our prostate gets bigger. And as it gets bigger, it either grows out or it grows in. If the prostate grows out, who cares? I mean, you know, obviously, if you have a cantaloupe in your pelvis, that might be a problem. But if it's not affecting flow, you're okay, right? But if the prostate grows in and it affects flow, now we have a problem. So let's go back to what I said in the beginning. The bladder is all about volume. The prostate's all about flow. And that's how we explain it. So what I tell my peers is your bladder should void. Right. We want if you and I go back to the books, go back to Campbell's, you know, 300 to 500 mL. You go back to Kaplan's work and he says, yeah, functional capacity is 2 to 250. Okay, right. I'm running around in the office doing whatever. My normal bladder capacity, functional capacity should be 2 to 250. All right. So if the bladder is voiding frequently of small amounts, that is overactive bladder. That's the first thing. If the flow is affected, that's the prostate. So how do we determine flow? Now, when I was a urologist, and what you do in your office, you probably have uroflowmeters. You know, you can detect that thing. Yeah, I don't have that. You know, because I'm not a urologist anymore, and my colleagues certainly don't have that. Now, but is it really about the flow, or is it about maybe a characteristic of the flow? And there was I was working on a paper a couple of years ago, and I called up one of the gurus in the field on urodynamics, and I said, "What flow designates obstruction?" This is Paul Abrams. You know, we all read Paul's book. I mean, he's an amazing guy. And he said, "Matt, it's not the flow, it's the arc of the void." Right? And that's what patients know. So if I have a good arc to my void, what are the chances that I'm obstructed? Pretty low. If I'm dribbling, right, it's pretty high. So I live in Michigan. We have snow 11 months a year. So maybe 10 months a year. But I'll ask my patients, how is your flow? Do you have a good arc to your void, or can you write your name in the snow in script or braille? Right. Now they all chuckle, but they get it. Right. So that's how I delineate the problem if it's a flow issue or it's a volume issue. Now, I may need some more factors. Like I'll use bladder hats in my office a great deal. Those are really helpful because everyone will say, well, I'm voiding frequently of a lot. And then they come back and say, oh, it's not that much. Right. But that will help me determine which direction I'm going to go in. I'm going to go down the course of treating the bladder, or am I going to go down the course of treating the prostate? And that's first. Because then if the symptoms get better, let's say they come in, you know, I'm having urgency, frequency, nocturia. I mean, they all say the same symptoms no matter what they have. Right. And I determine maybe the flow isn't so good. So I may give them something to relax the prostate a little bit, facilitate flow. And if they come in and say, you know what, this is working, this is better, I'm happy, I'm great. All right. If they come in and say, you know what, my flow's a little better, but you know, I'm still having that urgency, or I'm still going a lot and it's still small volumes. Now I'm thinking about the bladder as a component as well. Okay. Just like Diane Newman was saying. On the other hand, I may start with the bladder if I believe flow is good. And if I'm treating that effectively, that's good. But if they then say, you know, the more I think about it, maybe my flows, I may add that. And I think we need to keep our mind open, especially with the males, because, you know, again, we all have a prostate, we all have a bladder. And the reality is, more often than not, it's a combination of the two. So that's
So
a
you're
very
using,
long answer for that.
no, but it's fantastic. I love how you can break down such a complex issue into very basic, plain spoken terms, right? It's a matter of flow, it's a matter of volume. So now that after you've encountered them on the first visit, they're coming back every year, every 2 years, how are you observing the symptoms evolving over time, 5, 10, 20 years, and how are you assessing them effectively during that time period? So we talked a little bit about diary. Are you guys doing IPSS? Have you guys started exploring phone apps for quantitative data of uroflow, maximum flow rates? Kind of where is that whole
Sure.
experience for primary care now?
Really good questions. A lot of things you just mentioned that I haven't thought of, which should be kind of interesting. I'm fascinated by the idea of a phone app to detect your flow, and that could certainly help us. You know, but what you said in the beginning concerns me in a way that we can do better. When you said, how do you see them now that you've determined this is a problem, how do you see them back in a year or 2 years, if I'm quoting you correctly? If they're coming into my office and saying they have a problem, then I'm going to initiate therapy of some sort or another, whether this is a bladder or the prostate, and I'm going to follow up with them quickly. You know, maybe 2 weeks at a very, you know, on an outside, I'm going to do 4 weeks. And in primary care, follow-up with the patients is so important for us. And it's one of the things that I'm not sure I would love to see the urologist pick up on a little better. And again, I'm not trying to be critical. I'm just saying, when you say, here's your medicine, follow up with me in 6 months, most often than not, they stop the medication. You know, because if they're not understanding it. And one of my mentors in school once said, Matt, you have a debt to a patient. Diagnose, educate, treat. Let them know what they're doing, why they're doing. So for example, I'll give them a medication in this case, say for the bladder. This is what I'm expecting it to do. This is what I'm hoping happens. This is the side effects to watch for. Let's touch base in 2 weeks and tell me how you're going. And that's me and the sidelines being a cheerleader, you know, rah, 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 go, let's get this taken care of. But if it doesn't work, you're going to let me know. So key quick follow-up is very important. And that brings up another point. You know, when you look at the number of patients that fall off therapy in this class of medications, right, who don't pick up the second script, who don't take it in a year. When we look at anticholinergics, and we're actually seeing this now in the beta threes as well, it's single digit percentages of patients are on the med after a year, right? Most of them don't pick it up. And I don't believe it's because the med's not working. I actually believe that it's more they don't understand why they're taking it. You know,
So
and
the
that's
diagnose, educate, treat. I think that's a great pearl.
yeah.
Diagnose, educate, treat. And that segues nicely into like, what are your main treatment go-tos for OAB, BPH from your perspective, and kind of what's your algorithm?
Sure. So, and I appreciate that. We've actually published quite a few algorithms on this. There's a couple things out there. I'm really proud of the work we did on step one and step two. Step two was for the enlarged prostate. So, looking at OAB and then BPH and the combination of them and how we work through it. So, in regard to how am I treating, I'm trying to determine if it's a bladder issue or if it's a prostate issue. And the before I start treatment, that portion, I'll say it's really essential for us to do our best at figuring out what's going on, knowing we could be wrong, but that's why we have follow-up. And that's why I'm very set on understanding if it's the volume issue or if it's a flow issue. And the wild card that comes into this, to be honest, is post-void residual. You know, the, you know, primary care do not have bladder scanners. We don't do that. Now, I have one because I do research, so I'm an exception, but you have a bladder scanner. And for you as a urologist, I'm not saying you, but as a urologist, becomes a vital sign, right? Well, it's not a vital sign for us. So the question that a patient has is, well, you know what, if I, or the doctor has, I, you know, the patient might be having a problem with the bladder. How do I know it's not overflow? Right? You don't. You actually don't know that it's not overflow. But there's some clues out there. And the first clue is flow. All right. If a patient comes into me in a male and I have urgency, frequency, and nocturia, and my flow is good, what are the chances that they're obstructed? It's pretty much zero. Right. On the other hand, if their flow is weak, then I'm thinking about it. So what I do, and we've published this in a couple articles, we say, look, go write for a bladder ultrasound at whatever facility is close to you. And if the PVR is less than, you know, 50 mLs, go ahead and treat it. If it's above 50, then refer off to the urologist. Let them deal with it. But now you've identified the problem and you're letting the urologist take it. Now, the urologist will have a higher threshold for PVR, but again, we're trying to bring it down to the primary care doctor who sometimes can get a little skittish with that. Not a big deal. And this is a really easy point because they're really not doing a lot of added work. They're just getting that post-void residual. So let's say I have a patient that comes in now and the PVR is low. Right, the flow is give or take weak or not. Okay, well, we'll go through that, and we know that they have poor volume, so we know we have a bladder issue, we know we have a prostate issue. My first order to treat, it's in some male, I'm going to always start with flow. And the reason I'm going to start with flow is there's not really an adverse effect for treating them for flow. And the alpha blockers, as you know, will work very quickly, right? So I'll tell a patient, look, you may see an effect in a day, maybe 2 days. I'm going to see you back in 2 weeks. We'll know if it's working. All right. Then they come back in 2 weeks. Now they're saying, for example, my flow is good or my flow maybe not as good. If their flow is really not improved, now I'm thinking, do I really know if there's an obstruction or not? I don't. Now I may refer them off. All right. On the other hand, if the flow is improved and they're doing better, I'll ask them, how can I make you better? Well, you can decrease this urgency for me, or maybe the nocturia. Now, we'll have to put a flag on that because I want to talk about nocturia in a minute too, because nocturia is not always the bladder or the prostate. Nocturia sometimes could be the kidney. We've got to be aware of that. So now I'm looking at the bladder. And if the bladder, so I'll look at a bladder log. I love bladder logs. I absolutely love them. It's funny, going back to Diane. Diane and I get into a fist fight every time we're back and forth like that, because she goes, Michigan is the only state that does bladder logs. I can't get my patients to do them at all. And I'm like, well, we do it all the time. We love bladder logs. And I'll have the patients put them on the toilet at night, right? And they can measure how much they're peeing, right? Because I want to see that capacity at, 200 to 300 mLs. And David Staskin, another mentor of mine, taught me a really good trick with the red Solo cups. Right. So what Dave said, and I love doing this, I'll tell a patient, get six red Solo cups or whatever, if you get an offer, I don't care. But line them up in the bathroom. And you get up at night, you pee in the first one. The second time you get up, you pee in the second. So you don't have to measure when you're actually awake, right? As opposed to measuring while you're half asleep. And that works beautifully. Patients are very happy with that one. So that's kind of a nice little hack into this.
And so when you're layering on, so alpha blockers, when you're addressing flow first, then if they're starting to have more irritative voiding symptoms, are you layering on first with an antimuscarinic, or talking a little bit more of the latest, the beta
Sure.
3 agonists are now here? Do you have to worry about the drugs interacting with each
Yeah.
other, the mechanisms of action, efficacy, safety? Kind of how do you
Sure.
process that?
Yeah. So once I determine, so great question. So once I determine that it's a volume issue, now I'm going to treat it. All right. So just as you're saying, so what do I choose? So we used to only have, let's go way back in time. I think I'm a little older than you are, Wayne, but let's go way back in time to when I was in medical school. And all we had were the immediate release anticholinergics, right? Which are really very effective drugs if you didn't mind having a cotton mouth. And I mean, I could use oxybutynin 30 milligrams and dry anybody up. But I ask them how they're doing. I'm fine, but I can't talk, because they're so dry. It's a great efficacious drug with side effects that are way out there. Can't do it. So then we got to the point of the extended release anticholinergics, and those have a markedly better side effect profile, right? They work. It's a better profile, but still not perfect, And recently, we started worrying about all these cognitive issues with that. And are you familiar with the Beers list?
The Beers list?
The Beers list, not the Beers list. My wife thinks it's the De Beers list, which is diamonds, but it's the Beers list. And the Beers list is, hopefully she's not going to see this taping because I'll get in trouble. But the Beers list is the do not use this in the elderly population list. There's a colleague of mine, Ted Johnson, down in Atlanta. I love to give a shout out to Ted. He's a gerontologist. He's brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant. And Ted's written a lot about this. But these are the meds we should be careful of. And unfortunately, the anticholinergics are all over that, because the older we get, the worse the effect on that. The side effects are amplified, and the cognitive issues are amplified. So the extended release anticholinergics were very good from an efficacy standpoint. From a safety standpoint, not so good. So now, 10 years ago plus, we were introduced to the beta 3s. Now, remember, the focus of that, the antimuscarinics stop the contraction. The beta 3s facilitate the relaxation, with the end goal in either drug is that you're going to allow more to be held in the bladder. So that's the way that we look at that. So now we've got the beta 3s, and the beta 3s have a very, very healthy side effect profile, very good side effect profile for us. And the nice thing is it's safer in the elderly population. So we go back to the question. You got a very long-winded answer to get to the question. What do I do? Okay. So let's say, and I'm going to stratify this. I have a young male, no flow issues, the problem's the bladder. All right. I could use anything. All right, I'm going to be happy with anything at that point because I'm not worried about the side effects. If I have a young male with bladder issue and prostate issues, I'm going to start with the prostate first and then add on the bladder. Okay, then add on to that. And again, I could use any medication. As they get older, right, now I have to worry about the cognitive issues. So in the OGS guidelines, the American Urogynecologic Society guidelines that came out during COVID, they basically said, are you familiar with the Choose Wisely program?
And tell us a little bit more.
In the Choose Wisely program, they said, you know, do not use an anticholinergic in somebody who's older, and they match age 70 with age. So as you get older, age 70, don't use anticholinergics. You should only be using beta-3s in this class. Now, as a PCP, you know, it's interesting. Not everybody is the same age at 70, you know, in terms of physical age. I mean, I have 70-year-olds that come in the office quickly to go to the golf course to play with their dad, right? You know, and I have 70-year-olds that are unfortunately in nursing homes, right? So, you know, I have to worry about that. So not everybody ages is the same way. And the other thing that I worry about with the anticholinergics, and Peter Sand taught me this, and it was I thought it was one of the smartest things I ever heard Peter said. Yeah, I don't know if you know Peter, he's a urogynecologist out of Chicago, is now retired. But he questioned us once at a research meeting, and he said, we're worried about the age and the effect on that anticholinergics have. What about the cumulative effect of anticholinergics over time? And we're all sitting there saying, Peter, my God, you're right. What do we do here? So let's say 65 is that age where it's, yeah, we really don't want to be giving an anticholinergic. We want to use a beta-3, but what about 60? Because if it's working at 60, they're going to be using it till 65, right? So, you know, again, I can't tell anybody how to do it. I can tell them how I do it. And I start thinking about that cumulative effect of antimuscarinics early on. So in my world, I actually prefer as we get older and, you know, I say, you know, later 50s, if I'm looking at this as something over time, I'm like, maybe I'm going to stay away. Maybe I'm going to decrease the cholinergic risk, the anticholinergic risk, and I'm going to go to a beta 3.
I really appreciate you kind of highlighting the anticholinergic burden, especially in your world. I mean, one of the big things that we advocate for is ending the polypharmacy epidemic. How can we contribute to decreasing the number of drugs that have anticholinergic effects? And I'm sure in your world, you guys have worked with acbcalc.com, where you can put in all these medications and actually measure, right, and quantitate the anticholinergic burden. And for those who are listening, it's a great resource. And I think we're learning so much from primary care and from urologists around the country and around the world who are really looking at that anticholinergic burden.
Yeah, and so that's a great point. And, you know, the there's some stats out there. Remember, as you get symptoms of OAB or BPH, it tends to happen as you're older. In that patient at that age, we're looking at, you know, an average of 8 or more medications per person with that diagnosis. So they're on a ton of medications. And you do have to worry about that interaction. And one of the things I talk to my patients about all the time is kind of a problem we have in primary care. It is when patients will come to me, say, I'll get a new patient, it's 70. And I look at this list of medications, it's on 2 pages. And I'm like, well, you don't really need half of these medications, right? And what happens is we get this cumulative effect. They see one doctor, they get a med. They see another doctor, they get a med. We are very, very good at starting medications. We are very bad at stopping them. So one of the things that I try to do, and I know a lot of my peers do, is we look at these lists in the primary care office. We look at these lists of meds and say, really start questioning, why are you on this? Why are you on that? You know, making and go back to the debt to the patient, the diagnose, educate, treat. I'll ask them, why are you on this medication? Did anyone explain that to you? And I will tell you, it's pretty interesting what we find and how often we can stop medications.
And I think, like you said, medications have their role and they can be excellent chronic management strategies. And just about understanding, right, the mechanism of action, efficacy, and safety profile. One thing I wanted to come back to, because you brought it up, and I think you have talked about it very eloquently, which is nocturia. And talking about desmopressin, for example, you know, because we've talked about beta 3 agonists, vibegron, so forth. For nocturia, desmopressin, you've done some great educational talks on that. Could you share a little bit about your perspective on that?
So we have looked at that quite a bit, and thank you for so you're probably the only other person who's looked at those talks, so thank you very much. But I think my mother looked at them at some point. But so what is nocturia? And that's a confusing thing. So we talk about, you know, the bladder is about volume and the prostate's about flow. So what about the patient who's coming in having nocturia, who has a good flow and is voiding 300 to 500 mL every time they void, doing it every 2 to 3 hours? Well, that's not a bladder problem. That's not a prostate problem. That's a kidney problem. So why is your kidney overproducing? And nocturia, by definition, is when you're producing an over a large amount of urine at night, and it's 2/3 of your volume at night. So, you know, why is that? And but this is the tricky part. So you see this very commonly in patients on diuretics. You see it very commonly on patients with congestive failure, lower extremity edema. They get in that supine position, and now they're mobilizing fluid. All right. So medications to treat nocturia, like desmopressin, can be very good, but we have to worry about the electrolyte issue. So the normal thing is to get rid of that fluid. If we stop them and concentrate the urine so they're not voiding as much, then we can end up in a hypoosmolar situation. So the sodium goes, for example, hyponatremia, and that could be have some devastating effects in the elderly population. So the trick with nocturia that I have found is managing it appropriately. You know, if they're on a diuretic, I'm asking them, to, hey, why don't we do this? Let's take the diuretic at a different time. If the problem is at night that you're voiding too much and you're taking it during the morning, take it at night. See if that changes something, or vice versa. The other thing I'm telling them is, you know, maybe when you're home watching the news, you know, you've had your dinner, it's early, it's 6 o'clock, you're going to watch news for a little while. But why don't you get that ottoman and put your legs up? Right? Because that's going to help you get it out before you go to bed. It's going to make it a little easier for you. We use support hose. Those are very good. Right? And the other thing, and believe it or not, this makes a big difference, is let's put a time to when you're going to stop drinking copious amounts of fluid. Right? Because, you know, it's amazing how much people will drink at night and they don't register it. So I not only do bladder diaries for voiding, but I'll actually do intake diaries, and I'll ask them, you know, and I have a very funny picture I've used in some of the talks, and I'll explain this a little bit. So it was my lovely wife, who's amazing, who was talking about, you know, well, this is terrible. As we get older, we void more at night. And I said, no, it's not terrible. We void more at night. It's that gallon of water you have next to your bedstand, because you watched on the news that drinking a lot of fluid is a really good idea at night. And it's really not, right? Hydration is a good idea, but you don't have to be guzzling water all day long. So the funny picture is one night that when she was, you know, questioning me on that. And I said, that's fine. I had a picture of, she was asleep, and my 12-pound dog's had his entire head in her water. And I said, at least somebody benefited. So
in your world of primary care, you kind of touched upon it, and I just want to dive a little bit deeper, which is, you know, if the primary care provider is getting a PVR and it's greater than 50 cc's, that might be a good time to now send that person on to urology. Are there other things that you all talk in your community and your chats about when to send these dual diagnoses or even singular diagnoses onto us urologists? Kind of where has that dialogue been and where is it going?
Sure. Let me start by saying why we came up with a 50 ml point. And this was a paper that I wrote years ago with that. A lot of the people we talked about today, Dave Staskin, you know, Kaplan, they were all on this paper. And we kind of, what we looked at is, what is the PVR should make us nervous, right? And there's a little bit of a different threshold for urology and primary care. What we found is that the possibility of going into retention at a volume of less than 50 when you start an anticholinergic is essentially zero. And you can go back to a lot of studies that were done when you dissect who went into retention on those. So that's why we went at that number for 50. But anything above 50, we will refer off. When we look at the area of other reasons, we will want them to go to the urologist. And it's basically, first of all, it all starts with, if I'm not comfortable, I'm going to send them off to the urologist, right? And I'll tell my peers this, look, I'm a lot more comfortable. I've had 6 years of training as a urologist. I can handle most of this, but I understand you're not. So let's try to get you to that comfort level. So if you're unsure of the diagnosis, refer, right? If there are red flag symptoms, I want you to refer. You know, for example, blood, that's a red flag, right? Pain, which could be, for example, interstitial cystitis or painful bladder syndrome. I know that's a new term. Primary care, not necessarily comfortable with that, refer the patient off. If you've had recent surgery or prostate surgery or bladder surgery at any point and these problems happened, like a temporal relationship, and, you know, send the patient off. So, you know, that's how that works for us. And so I'll tell them, if there's a safety issue, if you're concerned, you know, you always want to be safe. There was a piece I wrote for, I was asked for Urology Times, which we're talking about today. Years ago, I was asked to write a piece on why primary care do not deal with overactive bladder. And my answer in the article I wrote was, you know, simple, effective, and safe. We need a simple way to diagnose the problem. We need effective treatment modalities. And number three is we need to have modalities that are not going to hurt anybody or a diagnosis. You know, I don't want to say, oh, I'm treating you for OAB. And then the urologist say, my God, you missed this fill in the blank malignancy. That makes me nervous. I don't want to do that. I don't want to put my patient at risk. So as long as we can keep it simple, safe, and effective, then our simple, effective, and safe the other way around, I think we're doing the best for our patients. And that's what I try to teach my colleagues.
Well, there's so many great pearls here. Just to some takeaways, at least for me, breaking it down for flow and volume, when you look at BPH and OAB, your DET, DET, diagnose, educate, and treat. And can you just one more time for the listeners, the De Beers list, what does it stand for again?
Oh, the Beers list. I don't think you caught me on that one. I think Beers list was named after Beers.
Oh, okay. So it's spelled B-I-E-R-S?
B-E-E-R-S, Beers list. Primary care are all familiar with that list. They basically don't use this in the elderly population. Most of the time now, our EMRs are going to say, you know, if you're writing a medication, be a little cautious of that. That certain med. Now, for example, all the anticholinergics are on that. So if you're writing for a patient with OAB and you're putting in, you know, for an anticholinergic, you're going to get an alert on your EMR says this, you know, has cognitive issues in the elderly population. So the reality is we really shouldn't be using it.
Yeah. So as we gain awareness about the cognitive decline and dementia with anticholinergics, I think we're going to start seeing that rise in beta 3 agonist use.
Oh, pretty much. Well, you know, it's interesting what you just said on understanding the rise of cognitive decline. There's a lot of work going on in primary care on that right now. You know, if you actually look at the data, about 15% of the population above the age of 65, and some people even say higher numbers, have some sort of cognitive decline. The problem is, how do we identify it? And we don't. You know, if a patient in 2024, you know, they'll come into my office because the family is saying, you know, dad lost his keys again. We saw him wandering. It's something brought them into the office. Maybe they went to the hospital. Maybe they hurt themselves, right? And that becomes our screening. And that's not a good screener, right? We can't be reactive. It's the same thing with overactive bladder. You know, we want to be proactive. I don't want to wait till the patient, you know, has a catastrophe. I want to let them know this is not normal, bring it up. So for cognitive issues, this is a big deal right now. And I think what you're going to be seeing is more and more, not more and more, but you're going to start seeing cognitive screeners introduced in primary care, and we're being asked to do that. One of the hats I wear in my life, I'm the chief medical officer for a large ACO, Wovana, out of Nashville. And that's something that I am tackling as part of our group. How do I get my 2,000 physicians to start screening, because we know that the problem is if unaddressed cognitive decline, even though we don't have a lot of great treatments, but unaddressed cognitive decline results in very high healthcare costs, overutilization of urgent care, ER, medications, catastrophic events. So if we can start getting that taken care of earlier, identifying it, I think we're doing a great deal for our patients.
And I guess for me, just leaving off on, yes, let's find ways to be referring people that with techniques and technologies that are simple, effective, and safe, like you said. And I would just submit, maybe have your team look at those phone apps. That would be a quantitative measurement over multiple measurements over time that could be right. used as a trigger for a referral for what we call a bladder health baseline. Where are you at? Yeah. What type of risk are you at?
Yeah, I think that would be great. And I think we're in a, we have so much information out there with the internet, now with AI, and we're right on the cusp of being able to predict things that people do. As part of my work with Lovana, I'll tell you, I'm working with quite a few AI groups developing predictive modeling. So this is one of those. At what point on this, if I address, hey, you're getting up at night or you're spending more time in the bathroom, for example, maybe we should kind of turn this around earlier. That would be fascinating. And that would be part of how we do these apps. There's something, I'm working with a really interesting group out of New York that is doing, you've probably heard of chronic care management. And they're showing patients apps on things like this as well. And it would be interesting. I'm going to actually, after we finish today, I'm going to call them up and say, have you thought about asking about the bladder health as part of this? Because that could be predictive as well. So you're right. I mean, it's, a patient empower yourself, and the more information we give them, the better they're going to be for us.
So in one of our dialogues, we have a hashtag, which is we want patients to be empowered to come into your office, go, hey, hashtag, what about my bladder? To be at the top of mind when they're having that urgency, frequency, OAB, urgent continence, to really tackle that. And you are uniquely situated to make all that happen, that interface between urology and primary care, right? Because it's going to be an interplay. So for example, yes. If the PVR cutoff is less than, over 50, for urologists, they might we're overworked. We can't see all those people. So can we compromise, maybe make it 100? So it'll take that dialogue.
As long as the urologist is willing to back me up,
I'll back you up.
Me as a PCP, if you're willing, hey, Matt, try this. And if it doesn't work, right, send him over to me. Once upon a time, I thought it'd be really interesting. It was years ago. I said, if I was telling one of the companies I consult for, I was saying, if I were a urologist now, I would take my business card when we still had them. I'd slap them on the back of every sample of whatever you're selling. And I would say, have your primary care give this. And if it doesn't work, have them call me. Now, clearly we can't do that, but that's the backup. If you call, and here's an interesting question for you, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but how often do you and your colleagues call the primary care and educate them when you see, when you see a consult? Hey, I see you sent this patient for hematuria, but next time, you have a patient like that, hey, get a renal ultrasound, a cytology, get a CT, and then send them to me. It'll expedite things, right? Because the interesting thing is this is for the urologist and all. I was actually lecturing at the AUA on this years ago. I said, how much training do you think the average PCP has had in urology? And the reality is in the American, to sit the board for family practice, you have 2 weeks of ophthalmology, urology, or dermatology. All right. Now, if you're smart, you're going to do ophthalmology over Christmas break because you're never going to see anybody. They're going to all be, the ophthalmologists are all on vacation. You're not doing any work. But the reality is you're not getting a lot of urologic education, but yet you're seeing there's not a day that goes by in a primary care office that you're not seeing a patient with a urologic disease. So as opposed to saying, what the heck, how come you don't know this? Why don't you actually teach them a little bit?
Yeah, no, I'm guilty as charged. I feel like a little bit swamped and I need to do a better job of reaching back out.
And we're all swamped. It's not like this isn't a game of I'm more swamped than you are. We're all swamped. But the interesting thing is in primary care, we are the masters of nothing. because we don't specialize, but we're the knowers of everything. All right. So a patient will come into my office with a problems ranging from the top of their head to the tip of their toes. Right. With in urology, it's between your belly button and your kneecaps. There's not much else there. You know, I remember in residency, I made the mistake of questioning the chairman at we were having rounds, and he was badgering the primary care referral, the doc who referred the patient in, saying, you know, if the primary care doctor had sent this patient in earlier, the outcome would have been different. And I asked the question of why would the primary care doctor have known to send the patient in? And to be honest, I got in a lot of trouble for asking that question, but I was actually right. So if we can switch the paradigm so that the urologists are working in sync with all of their primary care in their localities, I think it would be great. One of the things I was working on a long time ago, we were trying to set up meetings between, you know, when we're, if it's product or something else, grand rounds where the urologist comes in and talks to a group of primary care and say, look, this is what we're doing. Let me teach you the basics of on when to send the hematuria, when to send the OAB, when to send the LUTs, and just know I have your back. So if anything can come out of a meeting like this, that's what I'm hoping happens. You know, get on, we got to go old school. We get on the phone and call.
Well, I think as we all go analog, I think it's a great message to end on, which is to all our fellow urologists, yeah, reach out, pick up the phone, reach out to the primary care docs, take 3 minutes to educate, start that dialogue back and forth to figure out what's going to work out, work best for the patients in your community, since each community is unique.
Exactly.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rosenberg. You were awesome. And really, thank you so much for all your wisdom.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.